I'm Kara Keehan, and this is Behind the Bench from AJP Hart and Cirque. Today we're talking with Michael Sayegh, an MD PhD student in the Joint Wallace H. Coulter Department of Biomedical Engineering at Emory University and Georgia Tech. Michael collaborated with Dr. He Chiol Cho, who, like Michael's PI, Dr. Rebecca Levitt, has a joint appointment in Emory Medicine and Georgia Tech Biomedical Engineering. Their article titled Strength Duration Relationship as a Tool to Prioritize Cardiac Tissue Properties That Govern Electrical Excitability was published in AJP Heart and Cirque in June 2019. When I talked with Michael to get the scoop on his science, he told me that he thought his story wasn't that interesting. On the contrary, I was both humbled and inspired. His personal story is one of perseverance, determination, and good luck. If anything, we could all use an inspirational story right about now. Liz?
Thank you, Kara. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. We're extremely excited to have you here, and we cannot wait to have the story behind your story. Before we start on the Story Behind Your Bench project, could you please give us a summary of the goals and the main results from the manuscript you published with AJP Hart?
Yes, thank you very much for having me. It's really a pleasure to talk with you. This paper came out of an interest in the laboratory of Dr. Cho that I was in the electrical properties of these reprogrammed pacemaker cells that they study. And we were interested in the different properties of these constructs in vitro that would make them more or less excitable, because as a model of the heart's SA node, they have to be protected from outside electrical influence. So we studied different aspects of these cells. For example, we studied the direction in which they were cultured, whether they were aligned with each other or randomly aligned, the size of these constructs, whether there are more cells or less cells in a construct, the presence of other cell types that are common to the heart, such as fibroblasts, and finally, whether we reprogrammed these ventricular myocytes into pacemaker cells, how all these factors impact their electrical excitability when an outside electrical field is imposed, which is what these cells experience in the environment of the heart. Then we also looked a little bit into the interactions of these cells with each other. Specifically, we looked at connexin 43 and incadherin, and we saw that when fibroblasts were added and when the cells were randomly aligned, connexin 43 fragments into these smaller aggregates, and that may explain why they're harder to excite. And finally, we looked at reprogramming ventricular myocytes into pacemaker cells, and we found that this also makes them hard to excite. And we think that all these properties are relevant to making pacemakers for the heart out of biological substrate like these ventricular myocytes. And then these properties would help us understand how we can protect these constructs so that they're not overrun by the large heart when they're actually used as a pacemaker.
So one of the things I really appreciated from your study design is you used both 2D and 3D types of cell cultures. Mm-hmm. And you did observe different data, right? Different results depending if you were using the 2D and the 3D, specifically when you were adding the fibroblasts. Mm-hmm. So what did you conclude from there?
So when we use the fibroblasts in a 3D mode, the fibroblasts tended to run out of the 3D construct as opposed to stay in the center of this spheroid that we were making. So that made it difficult for us to study the fibroblasts in conjunction with the ventricular myocytes. Whereas when we plotted the cells in 2D, we saw more of an effect of the fibroblasts on the construct that we were making. And we think, you know, the cell interactions differ in 3D and 2D in a pretty major way. So we definitely think there's a difference there. And I would like to find a more robust 3D system, perhaps, to study these interactions in the future than making a spheroid.
Yeah, I agree. I thought this was a really interesting part of the project, because every time we use our in vitro models, we try to get as close to an in vivo situation as possible. So you would think a 3D would give you more information compared to the 2D. But as you said, probably you do need a more robust 3D model.
Mm-hmm. We were aggregating ventricular myocytes by seeding them into these plates called Agarwal plates with an inverted pyramid in a lattice on the bottom. So the cells would kind of drop to the peak of the inverted pyramid and aggregate together into these small spheroids. And we either added fibroblasts to the myocytes or not. And that's how we got the different fibroblast to myocyte ratios.
I'm always intrigued by these studies that seem to really, you know, reinforce the idea that cells like their normal physiological environment the best. And it sort of begs the question about the sensing of that environment and whether or not there might be ways, instead of us experimentally trying to reproduce the exact physiological environment to make these cells happy, whether or not we can essentially modulate that sensing mechanism to make them more happy in our experimental conditions. Do you think your study sort of identifies with that at all?
I think we were trying to do exactly that. We were trying to see, can we isolate factors that are relevant to the conduction system of the heart and the sinoatrial node specifically, and study them and see if the myocytes and the reprogrammed myocytes are quote unquote happier in this environment. So we know, for example, in the normal heart, in the normal state of things, you know, the 3D heart, the sinoatrial node is more insulated. It has more fibroblasts, and the conduction system has a ring of fibroblasts that isolates it from the rest of the heart. And that kind of motivated our interest in studying fibroblasts with the myocytes, and we tried to co-culture them. However, whether co-culturing them together in 2D or in a spheroid is the ideal way, or maybe having them in some other 3D construct that would more closely mimic the actual heart may give us more informative results. I am not sure, but we're always looking for these new tools.
As you're starting on your journey here in this, how close do you think we are getting to be able to use these cardiac tissues as therapeutic opportunities? And you're an MD PhD, so I don't know sort of what your MD plans are as well, but this could be something that creates sort of a long-term clinical opportunity as well. Is this something that you're interested in staying in, or how well it aligns with your clinical interests at the moment?
The MD PhD, bridging the bench to the bedside, is definitely the goal here. I think it's every trainee's dream to see their work on the bench translate to actually benefit patients, especially as an MD PhD trainee. And a lot of my colleagues have that goal as well. I would like to become a cardiologist in the future. And things like these biological pacemakers have mind-blowing implications if they translate into clinical reality. Battery-powered electronic pacemakers work well, but they still have complications, and it's a foreign material that's placed into the body with electrodes that are wedged into the myocardium. So being able to use a biologic to pace the heart has many benefits. There is still a little bit of a way to go to be able to achieve that clinical reality, and whether someone like me may be able to place these in a patient in the future. I believe it's going to happen one day. I don't know exactly when.
Is developing or testing engineered biological pacemakers part of your PhD thesis?
So this was a rotation project when I was choosing a lab early in my PhD. And then I am currently doing my PhD in Dr. Rebecca Levitt's lab, also in biomedical engineering, and she's co-appointed in medicine at Emory School of Medicine. She's a practicing MD cardiologist, and she studies biomaterials in the heart as well as the immune reaction of the heart to different disease states like myocardial infarction. So she has developed new therapeutics based on biomaterials and mesenchymal stem cells that can improve outcomes in myocardial ischemia, as well as tools to be able to deliver these materials via a catheter without opening the chest to the heart, say after someone has a heart attack in the emergency room, to be able to modulate these effects. And I'm currently developing a gel that can target the immune response to a heart attack with the hope of one day that gel, if it works, it could be delivered to patients in the clinic.
That sounds exciting.
That is. Although, can I just go back for one second here to mm-hmm. this first author publication that you have is from a rotation project?
Yes, so I was rotating with Dr. Cho, and I was a little unsure about which lab I was going to join. I wanted to do something that had to do with cardiology, because I really liked that in the first 2 years of preclinical medical education. And then I was interested in being with someone who is a clinician scientist, so I veered towards Dr. Levitt's lab, and I ended up doing my PhD there.
And just to confirm, your lab rotations aren't normally like 2 years long, right?
Our lab rotations in the MD-PhD programs can be from 8 to 10 weeks long on average.
Oh my God.
I'm just saying it's a very impressive piece of work from a rotation. I was pleased when some of my rotating students got a middle authorship on one of our papers.
Thank you.
Michael, I am going to start to use you as a model for every single student that gets into my lab. I'll be like, do you see what he did in 8 weeks?
Oh, no. So for full disclosure, some of the reviewer response, because we submitted it and got reviewer response after a while, were done after I finished my rotation. So not the whole work wasn't completely finished during those 8 to 10 weeks.
Oh, well, then in that case, you're basically a failure. You weren't able to do the study, submit it, write it, and respond to reviewers in 10 weeks. Well, and just in that case.
I don't want to add to the stress of PhD students who are already under immense pressure.
No pressure, people.
One of the things that I noticed, though, looking at the very beginning of the paper, it's got you there as the first author. It says that you have appointments at both Emory and at Georgia Tech. So do you, on top of publishing papers in 10 weeks, do you also work at two different institutions, like day and night?
So I try not to work day and night, but the joint department between Emory and Georgia Tech is really unique, in my opinion. It's truly a joint department in the sense that there are buildings on both campuses. The students are affiliated with both institutions as well as the professors. And we really get access to a wide variety of faculty at both institutions, core labs, ability to choose a thesis lab in both places, as well as the full clinical acumen of Emory throughout the institution and the different hospitals and the doctors and the world-class biomedical engineering program at Georgia Tech that's really at the cutting edge. So I feel very fortunate to be affiliated with both places, and it's really helped me throughout my PhD.
So 8 to 10 years is a very long time. That's a lot of training.
Uh-huh.
You will be 115 years old by the time you graduate.
So, about that.
I mean, at what point had you decided that you were willing to make this investment of time to get 2 degrees?
That's a great question. And I ask myself that whenever I'm feeling like it's taking a little longer than I expected. So I come from an immigrant background, and that has instilled in me this sense of needing to find a quote unquote safer career choice where I will find a job later and be able to do something, you know, concrete, for lack of a better word, with my time. So my parents were encouraging me to become a doctor. My dad is a dentist, and a few people in my family are physicians. So they encouraged me towards this path. But I also really liked science growing up. I was a big fan of Richard Feynman. And at some point I thought I wanted to be a theoretical physicist. So the MD-PhD path was kind of a compromise between this abstract science, you know, at the very end of the spectrum, you know, theoretical physics, and wanting to have a safe, good job and interact with people as a doctor. And that compromise ended up being MD-PhD. And I mean, it's been very rewarding to be able to see the, you know, bench to bedside translation.
And I guess it doesn't hurt that you're going to fulfill family expectations as well.
Hopefully. I don't know. I hope.
I completely understand. I'm also from an immigrant background, and I'm the first and the only one of my family that decided to get out of the country to get a PhD and pursue her career. So they're very supportive, but of course they have high expectations, because if you're not here with us, you better be doing really well.
Definitely. I understand that.
Would you mind, Michael, sharing a little bit more about kind of your experience as a immigrant and a scientist, like what it was like coming over here?
Yes, for sure. I have to say it wasn't exactly planned. You know, I grew up in a very supportive family. They cared a lot about education, and my parents you know, really invested in our education in terms of, you know, learning foreign languages like English and French and exposing us to science and books. That was not very available where I grew up. And I grew up in Aleppo, Syria, before, you know, all the problems started. So we would travel to Beirut, Lebanon, which was, you know, 6 hours drive by car. And we would go to, you know, different libraries and always come back with a haul of books. So I grew up reading Harry Potter and watching American TV. And, you know, towards middle school and high school, I started getting interested in science books and I started reading Richard Feynman. And then my parents encouraged me to try to apply to American University of Beirut, which was this oasis of learning and free thought in our area of the world. And so I had to take the SATs, and I opened the SATs the first time in my sophomore or junior year of high school and figured out how the bubble sheet works. And I, you know, I know people here hate the SATs, but I found the logic of being able to answer the questions using your brain as opposed to memorization and solving these puzzles is very fun. So I ended up liking the study of the SATs, and I took it, and I got good scores. So I opened the internet. My parents were like, we're going to support you. It's expensive, but you can try to apply to places, you know, in the U.S. as well. And we had these distant relatives here who would visit every few years. So we had some connection, but I really didn't know anything about the college application process. So I figured that I may be able to help myself by taking these SAT subject tests. And I had learned everything in Arabic. So I had to, you know, we again went to Lebanon, got all the books in English, and I translated my knowledge of chemistry and physics into English, ended up taking these tests at the single international school in Aleppo, which is now closed, unfortunately. And they had this classroom where they set up a single bench in the center of the class with another table for the printer and the laptop with internet. And they printed out these SAT subject tests only for me, and I took them. And that was another experience for me, and ended up scoring well. And I sent out my applications and paid the fees to be able to come here. And fortunately, you know, I got letters that felt very much like, you know, the letter carried by the owl through the chimney for Harry Potter, and ended up coming here. And it's been a different life since then. I feel very, very fortunate to have come here. And I arrived in this country in 2011, right before things got really bad in Syria. So that was a, you know, huge stroke of luck. And I definitely have survivor's guilt for all the, you know, the friends and people I've who have not had the same luck as me to be able to come here.
What about your family?
My immediate family moved to the U.S. about a year after I did. My sister was attending a boarding school in Massachusetts, and they came here to see her start school and check on me as well, because I wasn't able to go back. And while they were here, the airport in Aleppo closed, and things just escalated really, really quickly. Even on their way to the airport, they had to change routes a couple times because the roads were closing, you know, in the matters of hours. So they ended up extending their stay here because they couldn't go back. And finally, we succeeded in adjusting our status. And now we are on a more permanent immigration status. So they have had to undergo their own adjustments. My parents went from, you know, very successful careers and an extended family in Syria to starting everything anew over here. But, you know, it's been about 10 years and now they have good jobs. And, you know, up until before this new situation arose with the coronavirus. But, you know, we feel very fortunate, and the whole experience is mind blowing, and just, you know, a lot of luck and a lot of people who helped and a lot of institutions that believed in me and my family. So we're really grateful.
That's really an amazing story, Michael. And no doubt you had amazing support and sounds like just an amazing family, but your own dedication and hard work, you know, made those opportunities possible. And it's just, it's very impressive.
Thank you very much. You know, I can't be more grateful for everything that's happened.
And you never told us which university you ended up coming to.
So I applied really naively to, you know, top schools based on, you know, US news rankings. And the first school that I got an acceptance from was Yale, and I was applying over dial-up internet. So I found out by having the title of the tab on my Internet Explorer software say congratulations. It was supposed to be like a bulldog that comes out from an envelope and sings to you or something, and that didn't happen. And then you know,
my no singing bulldog. I'm you must have been dying. Were you dying? All you saw was congratulations, but you didn't know how long did it take to download.
I could not believe that my parents were coming back from the gym. My mom's reaction was she was crying because that meant I was leaving. My dad's reaction was also classic because my dad's always a skeptic. So he was like, are you sure that's true or is that some sort of scam? And then we checked that it wasn't a scam. And the next morning I got acceptance to, you know, Harvard, which was also completely a surprise. And I ended up attending Harvard for my undergraduate. You know, in a few months, I took the end of high school exam in Syria and then moved to the U.S. And that was that.
I have to say, Michael, you're very humble. I hope that doesn't change when you become a cardiologist.
I hope that too.
The depth of your gratitude is just, it's lovely.
Thank you very much. I mean, I truly mean it when the investment of all the people and the institutions along the way, as well as, you know, all the luck that we've had over time is really amazing. It does come with some sense of, you know, like I said, survivor's guilt in that some people may have not, out of reasons outside of their control, may have not had the same opportunities. And that's really difficult to see.
So Michael, I have one last question for you, and I think it's really important insight into who you are as a person. What house?
Oh, I was in Adam's house in undergrad.
Gryffindor! Oh. Gryffindor!
No, that's right. Harry Potter. Harry Potter house.
Oh, okay. Well, Adam's house in undergrad is the Gryffindor of Harvard, in my opinion.
Yeah. I'll give it to you.
Good answer.
You didn't come into the U.S. on a flying motorcycle, did you?
No, it was a flying airplane, thankfully.
Do you have a Hagrid in your life?
A Hagrid in my life. I mean, I have had several Hagrids throughout my career. People who stand out were RAs in my undergraduate dorm in my building who were really supportive throughout my parents' immigration process. My undergraduate lab mentor, Howard Berg, who studied E. coli, and he was the first to discover E. coli's tumbles and runs, took me into his lab, supported me throughout the first summer of my undergrad career when I was supposed to go back home and I couldn't. So he had me in the lab and paid me, allowed me to work on campus in the lab, and really sparked my interest in biophysics and the biology side of lab work, and helped me throughout the MD-PhD application process as well. And now at Emory and Georgia Tech, you know, my mentor, Dr. Levitt, Dr. Cho, with whom I authored the paper, the MD-PhD program, and my colleagues in that program, and my friends have all been, you know, in different ways, I guess, Hagrids in my life. So I am grateful to all of them.
Thank you, Michael, for joining us. And thank you for reminding me why I love Harry Potter so much.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
This week, we got pretty far away from the bench in our conversation, but provided just an inspirational story from Michael Sayegh during this time where we're all separated physically. I think stories like this help to bring us together emotionally. And I look forward to our next episode where we can introduce a new trainee and hear their story from behind the bench.